I'm Chris Gates, and I'm an alcoholic. This is fucking awesome. I tell you a few things before we get started. One, people tell me I should watch my language, but that mostly means watching it come out of my mouth and get on you. So when I get worked up, words come out of my mouth. But it's my opinion, if you've ended up in this room without saying, what the fuck, out loud at least once, you have other issues. So also, at some point in the evening, I will openly weep. That's inevitable. I don't mind the crying. I mind the not being able to stop, but we'll see what happens when that comes, you know. I never know when it's going to happen. But inevitably, it does. So a lot of you guys hear me talk about my experience around the steps every day. So I had to think about how do I want to do this whole thing tonight. So I'm going to dive in and see what happens. Like I said, my name is Chris Gates, and I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And what that means is, I'm a binge drinker and a low-bottom heroin addict and crackhead, and my sobriety date is October 5th, 1998, and no one is more surprised about that than me. You know, I was actually born in Austin. I think there's 12 of us that were actually born in Austin. Yeah, three of them are here. But Austin is the new motto for Austin is where average drinkers drink more than average. So I was born here and I grew up. There's no addiction in my family before this generation. There's no drugs and alcohol. I was a happy kid from a happy family. I had a wonderful childhood and all that was great until the first day of first grade. And then I left home and I went to school with those kids, and I don't know those kids. And I get uncomfortable around those kids. And so I started to eat. My malady first presented itself at 6 in first grade. And the story was always, well, you started putting on weight when you went to school because you're such an active boy, and now you have to sit all day. And that's a great story, and it's horseshit, you know? The truth is, I was uncomfortable around those people. And so I came home, and there wasn't drugs or alcohol at my house, but there was food, and so I ate. I was with the same 28 kids for 6 years, and I had friends when we were at school. But when I came home, I never did anything with any of them. I had a hard time making relationships with people. This carried on throughout my life. It's still something I struggle with a little bit. And then between 6th and 7th grade, well, back up a minute. When I was 7 years old, I saw the Rolling Stones on Ed Sullivan in 1968. That makes me 50-something now. And I knew for a fact at 7 years old I wanted to be a musician in a rock band. Beyond a doubt. So I started bugging my parents for a guitar. I started watching everything about music I could find. I grew up right by the UT campus, and I was like riding my bike around and mowing lawns to buy records from the hippies in my neighborhood. And it didn't matter what it was. I want to listen. Music is it. So right between 6th and 7th grade, my family moved about a mile. And I moved out of the middle school district where all my friends from grade school went to a new middle school where I didn't know anybody. And I got to middle school and I felt real different. I mean, I have teenage daughters. I know everyone in middle school feels different. You know, it's a holding pen for hormonal lunatics, 7th and 8th grade. And everybody feels weird and different, from the head cheerleader to the guys like me. But I was a little different. I started going to concerts when I was 12, and I'm walking around 7th grade with a mono tape deck listening to Black Sabbath and Deep Purple, and the rest of the kids hadn't even discovered the radio yet, and I really was different than those kids. And I met a guy on the school bus at the beginning of 7th grade, and his next door neighbor sold pot, so I started smoking a lot of pot. Went real good with the food, you know. And I'm stoned all day every day from middle of 7th grade on. And I'm a good student. I don't cause a lot of problems. I was 6 feet tall and weighed 195 pounds in 6th grade. So yeah, I was a big boy. And I'm weird and I got long hair and people don't know what to make of me. And then I get to high school and the drinking age is 18, and I'm 6 foot tall and 200 pounds, and I have a beard down to here by the time I'm 16 years old, and getting alcohol was not a problem. They had a vending machine at the frat house that was near my house where you could put in a quarter and get a beer. So I did. A lot. But in high school, I discovered my people. The same guy that was selling me pot had been to California and brought back the first urethane-wheeled skateboard, 1974. And I start skateboarding, and I find about 25 people in all of Austin in the mid-70s who are skateboarding, and they're like me. They're my people. And we're listening to hard rock. We're smoking a lot of pot. We're drinking when we can and having a good time, you know? I mean, the short version of my story is it was really good. I drank and I used, and it was really good. And then I drank and I used, and it was okay. And then I drank and I used, and it was not so okay, and there were starting to be consequences. And then I drank and I used, and it was psychotically miserable, and I died a few times, and then I got sober. That's the broad version of my story. But at this point in high school, it was still working fine for me. You know, grades are doing good. I missed a lot of school. You know, I got pulled into the principal's office the first day of my sophomore year of high school, and they told me, you missed 72 days of last school year. That's 6 weeks. I just wasn't there on a lot of Mondays and Fridays, you know, but my grades were good, so leave me alone, you know. And then I get out of high school, and within 3 months, I'm starting college. I've cut off all my hair, and I formed a punk band with some of my skate buddies. And I really found my people. There's a club right down on the drag. It's punk rock 7 nights a week. And I'm hanging out with these people. And they're all drinking and they're smoking a bunch of weed. And they're having a great time putting bands together and playing music. And it's amazing. But there are some people that hang out at this club. And they're doing a lot of speed. And they make me uncomfortable. They're a little nuts. But by the time I'm 21, I'm drinking so much that I'm starting to pass out. I never blacked out, if you don't count Rohypnol, but we'll get to that later. But I passed out. And at 21 years old and 6 foot tall and 225 pounds, my friends loved me, but there was no dragging my big ass back to the car. So they would roll me on my stomach so I didn't do a Hendrix and leave me where I dropped. You know, and I woke up in the bushes outside a frat house where we had gone to steal the keg. I woke up in the alley behind a diner. This was happening to me all the time. And I never thought maybe I should watch how much I drink. My immediate solution was to go pal up to the guys doing speed. Because I'd gotten to know them and they weren't bad guys. So I added speed to the equation. The first band I was in did really well. Toured the country, made some records, having a good time. Still dabbling with drugs at this point, drinking, dabbling with drugs. That band broke up, and I started another band, and our motto was show up drunk, show up late, don't show up at all, you know? And that band was based around drinking and doing speed with my buddies, and we were out of our minds. Great music, did well, made a couple of records, did more touring. But by this point, I'm dealing speed because it's cheaper than buying speed. And it's Texas in the 80s. This is like stuff made out of nasal inhalers. It's not crystal meth at all. You know, like some biker guy with kerosene made this thing yesterday. You know, I spent a good portion of the early 80s going, ah, thank you, ah. You know that one? You've done that one? Did you ever come to looking at yourself in the mirror going, what the fuck just happened? That happened to me more than once. Holding a straw, looking at myself in the mirror, going, where are we? So I'm drinking and I'm doing speed. And I go to the West Coast on tour, and I run into some friends of mine who are putting rock bands together. And by this point, the punk scene for me had become tedious. And I wanted to be in a rock band. I was good enough on my guitar to play rock and roll. And there was an underground rock scene. My band did the West Coast tour, and everybody else came back to Austin, and I stayed in L.A. with this girl for a week. And I ran into these two guys who had been in this punk band I knew, and they had just started a new band. And we're playing our first show in the basement of this apartment complex with two other bands come to the show. So I go to the show. I'm loud, I know. I'm sorry. But I go to the show, and my buddy's band plays, and they're all right. a band called Faster Pussycat played their first show, and a band called Guns N' Roses played their fifth show in front of about 30 people in a room smaller than this. And I went, I want to be in a rock band. I'm moving to LA. So I came home and I packed up my crap and I moved to Los Angeles, which was like recreating middle school, because in 1985 in Los Angeles, all the guys were dressing like girls and trying to sound like Poison, and then I show up and the spandex don't come into 38 waist, you know? Thank God, you know, like, there's really no embarrassing wardrobe choices in my past for the most part. I'm happy about that. Not long after I got into Hollywood, I met this beautiful little goth girl who was dealing the best pure crystal meth I had ever seen in my life. And it was love at first 7-day run. You know, bonding after 7 days of no sleep, you know. She lived 2 blocks from my house and it was on, you know. And not long after that, I'm not doing the speed so I can keep from over drinking. I'm drinking to take the edge off all the fucking speed, you know. And nine or 10 months into being in Los Angeles, I have a band together. We don't sound like anybody else. We don't look like anybody else, but we're getting some gigs because I know people. And we get signed to Geffen. We get a major label record deal. Completely unexpected. I thought it was going to take at least a couple of years to make a dent. They sign us, they shove us in a rehearsal studio so we can write some more songs because we don't have very many. And life is going. And everybody in my band drinks like a fish. And we're doing lots of speed because I'm living with a dealer. And the band is great and it's going really good. And, you know, first record gets done. I'm starting to get to meet my heroes. The record comes out, the video's on MTV, I'm getting ready to leave on my first tour. And the DEA comes through the front door of the cook we're buying from's house. And his wife calls me, what do I do? Hang up. Don't, don't call me is what you do. All right, wrong number. So I sat down with my girlfriend and we had a conversation about knocking this off. You know, guys like me don't get opportunities like this. You know, think back across the history of all the rock and roll you've ever seen and ask yourself, how many of those dudes look like me? None. Leslie West. That's an old reference. But so we talked about knocking this off, and I think what we thought we were talking about was stopping doing drugs. I think that's what the discussion was supposed to be about. Definitely not selling anymore, but not doing anymore, because we were putting ourselves at serious risk. I was going to blow this opportunity if we kept going. We had no idea that we were so far past stopping that it was a joke. We didn't know. We didn't know anything about sobriety or addiction or anything else. So I climbed in the tour bus, stopped doing speed, climbed in the tour bus, and within a week and a half, I'm drinking a case of beer and a fifth of vodka a day and doing as much blow as I can talk the road crew out of, because they're the only ones getting paid at this point. And within 2 weeks, she's strung out on heroin, because there is no just don't do drugs. So I'm out on the road for 4 months. By the time I get home, I'm shaking when I wake up in the morning from all the booze. And I'm paying for all this dope. And so I go, fuck, I'm paying for it. I'm doing my half. You know, and so I ended up switching my drug of choice to heroin. You know, I'd been awake for the 80s. I could use a nap, you know. I was in New York once on tour with this other band, and they were all loony cokeheads. And we went uptown after our gig to this girl's house, and she's laying out big lines of China White. And we all do the heroin, and 30 minutes later, the dude from the other band goes, "This is the weirdest coke ever." Yeah. But the next day, he said it felt like he had a day off. So when I started doing dope, I knew that I was in trouble. But it was the first thing I had come across in a long time that fixed what was wrong with me. You know, if I look back on my history, by the time I got enough alcohol in me at 21 years old, I was passing out. You know, and I was passing out with 6 more ounces of alcohol still in my stomach, because I just went with alcohol. It was a problem. I couldn't I couldn't even slow down to figure out where I was in my alcohol consumption. I was just drinking until I passed out. And then I had to add speed to the mix. And after, and more speed and more speed and more speed. And when that stopped working, I moved to heroin. It's bigger and bigger spiritual band-aids for what's wrong with me. And I'm using and I'm drinking. And as long as you're making money in the rock business back in the 80s and early 90s, nobody says anything about your drug use. You know, a lot, everybody in LA was strung out. Everybody was getting carted off in ambulances. Listen to some of the lyrics of the from the rock bands in the early 90s. It's not, the party is gone. All the songs are about I'm dying and you're dying and we're dying and trying desperately to make it sound like it's still fun. You know, we were the Liars Club. You know, whatever you do, don't let on you're not having fun. So my band was doing pretty well. You know, I got to tour the world, all that stuff. We were working on our third record and we're on the same label as Nirvana. And everybody in my band came up through the punk scene. And when Nevermind hit, we looked at each other and went, well, it's been fun, but it's over now. You know, we weren't a hair band, but even Guns N' Roses wouldn't get their phone calls returned once Nirvana hit. So the band broke up and I got a job working for this fashion accessories designer. Oddly enough, he was 3 years sober and I was strung out of my mind. And I worked for him for almost a year. And near the end of that year, I realized that I was making enough money to afford to stay strung out forever. And that scared me to death. Because I remember early on in my heroin use, hitting this point where I knew nothing good was ever gonna happen for me as long as I kept using. And it's funny, because I had a lot of animosity about God and religion and everything else when I got to treatment, but my philosophy of living then was I don't pray for parking spaces. I take care of business and good stuff comes to me before I even know I need it. And the minute I started doing heroin on a daily basis, I knew that deal was over and I was not wrong. So once I realized I was dying, I sold half of everything I owned and bought a van and put the other half of everything I owned in it, including the girlfriend who had stopped talking to me because I wouldn't pay for her dope anymore. And we came to Texas, because there's no dope in Texas, right? I didn't know. Like, I didn't know anything about that. I didn't know how typical that was, the geographic. I didn't know. You know. So we load up the van and we leave Los Angeles. It's a 28-hour drive. It took us 4 days because heroin is not a good cross-country drug. You know, driving by Braille, you know, thump, 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 you know. So we get to Austin and we land at my dad's house and they don't drink there, they don't do anything there. We have almost no money and a bag full of codeine Tylenols to help kick with. And 3 weeks into our stay at my dad's house, my girlfriend had a psychotic break and we had to call EMS. And when they get to the house, they keep asking me, what did she take? What's she on? And the truth was nothing. She was on untreated malady, and she had a psychotic break because of it. So they put her in the hospital, and they doped her up on Ativan and calmed her ass down. And as soon as she got out of the hospital, I picked her up, and we brushed off our Spanish, and we headed for Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard, and it was on. That's an old touring trick. Doesn't matter what city you're in. Find Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. Doesn't matter. Sorry. But so once moving didn't make anything better, all bets were off for me. I stopped being careful. I stopped being anything, you know, and I didn't care if I lived or died. I spent every day wishing I was dead and terrified of dying, which is a, you know, an awesome way to spend the 90s. But I'm becoming reckless. And I'm a nice boy from a good family, and I'm carrying a gun everywhere I go. I'm getting more and more involved in crime that my dealer keeps introducing me to. I'm doing collections, you know. And this was an awesome opportunity, running around the west side of Austin with a gun, collecting money for people. And I spent the last 2 years I was using trying desperately to figure out how to stop. And no matter what I tried, I couldn't do it. So I got, every time I'd try to stop, I'd end up, you know, well, you know the drill. Every time I started to stop, I couldn't stay stopped. It was too miserable to be me. And then the first real miracle for me happened. The first sign that there may be a God out there. I'm sitting in my bedroom working on a handgun for my father, putting a target sight on it, and my dealer shows up. At this point, I'm growing weed in my house because one of my roommates, who was 21 years old, caught a coke possession charge and killed himself by overdosing in my house rather than go to prison. His addiction was pretty gnarly as well. So I'm growing weed in the dead guy's room and making a lot of money, so my dealer delivers now. And he shows up at my house, and I find myself sitting at my desk with a gun in one hand and a syringe in the other, trying to decide which one to use. And it wasn't that drug addict, alcoholic, why doesn't somebody come save me? I'm so wet up. It was just calmly, today or forever. These are my choices. And for just a minute, I'm across the room looking at my own back, going, how the hell did those become my only goddamn choices? I used to have a life full of possibilities, and now those are the only two choices I have. That's insane. There has to be something else, and I have no freaking idea what it is. Now, later that day, I'm channel surfing. I don't know how much later because I didn't use the gun, but some number of hours later, I'm watching television. And since I'm a little kid, anytime there's anything about music on TV, I stop and watch it. I don't care what the music is. Sonny and Cher variety show, don't care. It's music. I'm watching it. It wasn't like it is now. You know, you never got to see the bands you love. Maybe a picture once a year when they're on tour in a magazine or something. And I'm channel surfing, and I come across this story about a jazz drummer on 2020. And I go, all right, jazz drummer, cool. And they're talking about him, and he's lived in New York, and he played with all the greats in the 50s and the 60s. And then they said, and he was a heroin addict for 30 years. And I went, well, that's an interesting thing to include. And then they went on to say, now he's 10 years sober, and he's put together an organization whose sole purpose it is to pay for professional musicians to get help. And I went, oh my God, that's my shot. I didn't know Austin Recovery was here, because in 1998, in the world I lived in, nobody was sober yet. Nobody. Well, two people were, but we didn't know where they went. So I run in the other room, and I get on my computer and I go online and I look up this foundation. Of course, it takes 4.5 minutes to load the webpage because it's a dial-up modem and I'm on AOL. You know, I was like, there's one little picture. But I look up their information and I call them. And I'd love to say I was ready and they scooped me up and took me to treatment, but I had enrolled in school because what I really needed was structure. And I had a 26-day window before the next semester started. And they wanted me to go for 28 days. And I said, can I leave 2 days early to go to school? And they said, no, call us when you really want to go. Went, okay. So I hung out for those 26 days, and then I started school. And 2 weeks into school, it had not helped. And so I called them back and said, I'm ready to go now. And they gave me the phone number of a treatment center out in the Hill Country. And this is the point at which I got the second gift of my sobriety. I called up that treatment center and they said, oh, you're on methadone? We can't take you on that methadone. You need to just stop taking that methadone and we'll see you in 6 weeks. And so what they were telling me without being able to say it out loud because of liability is go back to full-time heroin use because that's a detox we can manage. You know, because if I would have walked in on the methadone, I would have missed everything they had to offer because I'd have been too sick to get out of bed. That was a gift, 6 weeks of working without a net, basically, because I had forgotten just how bad things really were. It was a mess. I wanted to go that day, and I had to spend 6 weeks waiting for the day to get here so that I could be ready to do it. That was actually a gift. The third gift I got was when my on-again, off-again, junkie crackhead ex-girlfriend, whatever. I mean, we kept breaking up because we were dying together, but we kept meeting each other in the same parking lots waiting for somebody, you know, how that is. So, but she sat me down. And during the 6 months prior to going to treatment, I was dead at least 4 times for sure. Like full respiratory arrest, EMS, the whole 9 yards. Because I didn't care anymore. You know, about 8 or 9 years ago, I was doing a stress test for some health insurance thing. And they're looking at the printout, And they're going, when did you have your heart attack, Mr. Gates? And I was going, I never had a heart attack. What are you talking about? And he's going, well, this thing that goes down here only goes down if you've had a heart attack. And I stopped for a minute and I went, would that Pulp Fiction thing count? Anyway, yes, sir, that would count. And I was going, oh, I did that twice in early 98. You know, at least four times, should have been dead. And my ex sat me down and said, you need to think about why you're going to treatment. Because if you go for the wrong reason and it doesn't work, I'm afraid you'll die for keeps. And so I went, okay, why am I going? Why am I going? Am I going because every time I leave the house, it's a felony? Am I going because I've got more warrants than I'm even aware of because the car I drive, everything is either expired or forged? And I spend all of my time running around doing stuff that's illegal. And I'm living in a house that the electric keeps getting shut off because all the money's going to dope, and it's being pushed off its foundations by the hill it's sitting on, and we had a fire, and I put it out and didn't tell anybody because I couldn't afford to move. Am I going because of all that? And really what it came down to is no. I'm going to treatment because I need to find a way to live and go to the grocery store and pay my cable bill without having to get high. And I don't know how to do that. I'm using a drug they use for amputations on the battlefield to pay my electric bill. That's a fundamentally different level of pain, you know, but I have to do it. That was a real gift, knowing that why I was here before I got here. So I land in rehab. I don't know anything about it, which is awesome because it gave me no time to work up an argument. I stumble up the hill on the fourth day of detox into what was my first on-campus meeting. Somebody starts talking about God. My head clears up for a second. I go, oh, fuck. And then I fuzz right back out, and that's the last thing I remember. You know, I got up the hill. Somebody who worked there helped me understand addiction. I always thought that if I could get the drugs out of my body, then my thinking would straighten out, then the hole in my heart would close up and I'd be a whole man again. But I'd get the drugs out of my body, my head would go completely insane, the hole in my heart would get bigger than me, and I'd get high every time. And the guy that worked there said, you got these in the wrong order. If we deal with this hole in your heart, the other two will straighten out on their own. He said, there's a spiritual solution to your problem, and although I didn't like that, it was the only thing I hadn't tried. So I went, okay. And I spent 2 weeks, we talk about this all the time, I spent 2 weeks arguing about whether or not God existed as an effort to do two and three, you know. But everybody there was there for multiple visits and none of them did a four step. So I knew I had to do that because nobody was paying for me to come back. Unfortunately, I landed in the hands of some guys who understood that some are sicker than others, and I was one of the sick ones. Like, I wasn't going to stay sober if they didn't get me connected quick on purpose. I had a little bit of grace at the front end that allowed me to go to treatment and to think for a minute. But they needed to get me through the steps quickly. And so they did. I got out of treatment. I did my fifth step a few days after I got out of treatment. I was making amends by the time I was 6 weeks sober.
I was throwing things on the floor the rest of the time.
It's my story, but I wasn't there for a lot of it, so I brought notes. So I'm cruising through the steps. I'm working on trying to do 10 and 11 really badly, but I'm trying. I've got an on awakening beginning to happen. I'm 120 days sober. I'm through with most of my major amends. And I'm feeling good. Like, I'm feeling better than I've felt in years. And I go sit down with my sponsor and go, dude, I think the promises are coming true. I think I found what the program has to offer. And he looked at me and went, no. No. And I don't know why it didn't make me mad, but it was like, what he told me was, you're better than you've been in 15 or 20 years, and you're still so far from good, it freaks me out every time I see you. And I went, so it gets better than this? And he was going, oh, please don't stop. Please don't stop. It gets so much better than where you are. And I believed him, so I kept going. You know, I struggled a lot with the God stuff, and I've told you guys the story, you know. I'm doing this anyway because I got no other choice. And I'm just having to put aside the idea of what this God is. And of course, at my home group, there's a guy who likes to say, my higher power, whom I choose to call Jesus, just because he's a fucker and he likes to annoy people. And so He keeps doing this. My higher power, whom I choose to call Jesus. And one day my brain goes, my higher power, whom I choose to call dude. And I start laughing because I'm an old skater. And I say dude to my, I'm all day long going, what the fuck, dude? Seriously, goddamn, dude. Apparently I'm praying all the time and it's fine. But at the end of meetings, I'm going to a lot of meetings where they say the Lord's Prayer and we're standing up and I'm not saying the Lord's Prayer because I'm not a Christian and screw that. Because that's my awesome 12-step program. You know, everyone says don't get in a relationship for the first year of sobriety, but nobody knows if that works because nobody does it. The first... Just because you're not sleeping with him doesn't mean it's not a relationship. You know, I mean, the first 6 months of my sobriety were like the first 15 minutes of Saving Private Ryan. You know, the sound keeps going off. And it's, I couldn't make whole sentences until 6 months sober, but that was all it really took. Whole sentences was really all it took to start hooking up at my home group. And so... So I've got my awesome 12-step program, if you include the 13th step, because I'm really only doing this for me. And I'm cooking along. I have to stop with the chaos very quickly. By 9 months, I'm not dating anybody anymore, because I've had to experience what in the day was called the Bolden breakup, which means you get the 530 and I get the 8, you get Rudamaya and I get Flipnotics. So I stopped. And then I'm at a reunion at the treatment center I went to. And there's 800 people at this reunion. Really powerful speakers all morning long. It's out in the hill country. It's beautiful. And just before lunch, we stop. And everybody holds hands and they're saying the Lord's Prayer. And I'm doing what I do. I'm looking around the circle to see who's cool like me, not saying the Lord's Prayer. That's what I do at the end of meetings. And I'm looking at standing in this circle. And I get halfway around the circle. Can't look right at it. If I get halfway around the circle and I realize that if half of these people were as insane and miserable as me, this is a miracle. And it was the first time that word ever had any true substance. You know, oh, it's a miracle. Oh, the lights worked. It's a miracle. Now this, if half of these people were as insane as me when they got to this place, the fact that they're here and they're sober on purpose in the daytime and they have car keys and they can leave later is a miracle. And it was like at that moment, the bush caught fire and I had a burning bush experience. I had been having small spiritual experiences for 18 months. It's like striking a match. I take the step, oh, look at that. And I trust God and I take action. Would you look at that? And I'm doing this every day for 18 months. And the cumulative effect of that is I woke up. The cumulative effect of all those spiritual experiences, I woke up and the world was different. In that moment, the world was different. So at that point, I realized that my sobriety was, my continued spiritual growth was contingent on working with others. So I'm sitting around meetings doing what you do. I'm holding up my hand and trying to be attractive because it's a program of attraction rather than promotion, right? I'm here to tell you that's horse shit. It is not a program of attraction rather than promotion once I'm sitting in the goddamn meeting. The 11th tradition doesn't have anything to do with the 12th step. Big Book says I'm supposed to draw the newcomer with a vision. You know, outside the rooms, I could be attractive, but inside the rooms, I need to tell you what's possible. So not long after that, some guy comes walking into my home group. He's about a 35-year-old Irish dude whose insurance only paid for 5 days of detox, and he's still see-through. He's so shaky. You know, and he raises his hand. It's his first meeting ever. And I go over to him and say, hi, I'm Chris. I'm your sponsor. And he just thought that's how it worked. He didn't know. But that's what I tell my sponsees to do. Because my spiritual growth is contingent on me carrying this message to somebody else. I can't hope they ask me. It's real easy to have a limited understanding of something if I'm using it for my own use only. But when I got to start trying to teach it, I got to understand it better. You know, you're going to ask me questions I haven't thought of when I'm sponsoring you. I got to figure out those answers, and it fills my program out. My recovery gets better. My spiritual growth increases. So I'm sober, and I'm working the steps, and I'm starting to build a life. And I'm setting up this quiet life like people in recovery around me seem to be doing. And then at about 2 years sober, I realized that the people around me, including me, are following this pattern where life's going along good and it's boring. And so they stand up and light themselves on fire just for something to do. I'm going to go sleep with her. Or I'm going to quit my job without another one and no other marketable skills. Or just creating this insane chaos out of self-will, almost just for something to do. And I got tired of fighting that fight. And I began to wonder what it might be like to create some positive chaos, to start taking things on purpose instead of waiting for life to shove them on me. So I went back to school. I had the courage to admit that I had no marketable skills and a job was not going to fall from heaven because I'm awesome. So I went back to school. I had spent most of my life developing skills that either no one would pay me for or I wasn't comfortable doing anymore, so well, now that I'm sober. So I got to find some way to make a living. That was an act of faith and courage, and it took a ton of inventory. You know, I'm thinking about going back to school, and I'm freaking out. I can't go back to college. He's going, no, but you can get an application. Damn it, okay. So I went back to school, and I got some training. Learned to be a web developer. Meanwhile, I had this job that was paying me really good and didn't require much of me. It allowed me to set my own schedule, so I was going to a lot of meetings, and then I showed up for work one day, and I didn't lose my job. I knew it was supposed to be. When I got there, the company was gone. They hadn't told us that their contract was canceled, and the job skills weren't transferable. I couldn't get another job doing what I was doing. And I'm losing my mind. It's funny now that at 2.5 years sober, I was losing my mind because I couldn't pay my bills when 2.5 years before I didn't pay my bills, ever. The mail didn't even get opened until it turned funny colors. I don't even got to look at the white version of the bill. We're waiting until it turns yellow or pink or something, and then we'll see how bad it is. So I go back to school, and I've learned how to do this web thing, so I start doing it. I had to sell my car, had to get rid of my apartment, had to rent a room for a couple of years in order to be able to build this freelance business. But I did, and I was taken care of. People in the fellowship looked after me. My higher power looked after me. The steps helped keep me sane through the transition. Started playing music again sober. Started getting to tour Europe and Japan and all these places that had been to once but was barely present for. You know, in the last part of the most successful section of my music career, I got to meet almost all of the people who I started playing music because of, and I missed almost all of it because I was miserable and high and not present enough to enjoy it. So I start getting to play music again, and it's amazing, and I'm traveling all over the world, I'm having a great time, and I'm running my own business. And I know I want a family, but I don't know how to put that together. So I spent 2 years working the steps and working with my sponsor to learn to be dateable and to learn how to pick somebody that was not insane. And after almost 2 years of working on that, I started dating my now wife. The last 10 years have been amazing. You know, life just keeps getting bigger and cooler and bigger and cooler because I'm not willing to settle for sober. Sober's a great start, but it's not enough. If you think the fear of going back to where you were will keep you sober for more than a couple of months, you're wrong. At some point, it's got to stop being I'm afraid of what's going to happen if I use again and start being I'm excited about what's going to happen if I keep doing this. Life is full of amazing stuff out there if I have the courage to admit I want it and the faith to go after it and I work the steps on it so I can build the foundation to support it when it happens. The running joke in my life is that I'm living the results of an ill-considered prayer for abundance. I got more good stuff in my life than I know what to do with at this point. There's a humility to that that's challenging, because in the early days of recovery, humility means, we use it to mean small. We use it in the beginning to mean stop trying to do things you can't do. Humility means right-sized, not small. But if I'm trying to do God's job, I need to be humble enough to admit I can't do God's job, I can only do Chris's job. But eventually I gotta also own the other side of humility, which is I have talents and skills that I was given at birth, and it's my responsibility to develop those things for the benefit of myself, my family, and the world. Every one of us has those, but it takes courage to admit it. Because what if I fail? What if people laugh? Whatever. But if I'm not willing to go after my dreams, life will get gray. And we don't live in the gray for very long. We're not good at it. We're not built for it. You know, 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I went to this musician's spirituality group, and everybody else there is a professional musician who's also in the rock band at their church, you know, and then me, and they're all Christians, and I'm totally not. And I'm explaining my take on a higher power and my spiritual path, and I started having conversations with the guy who's facilitating the whole thing, and he's encouraging me to go try and do this for a living. But I come out of a fellowship where people don't generally do it for a living. But he starts pushing me on it, and I start opening my mind to it, and that led to a job at a startup company doing support for people who are getting out of treatment and helping build that. And that job led here. My life just keeps getting bigger. If it stopped today, that would be awesome. But in 18 years, it's showing no signs of slowing down. So my job is to keep up. Because like, this is my life. It's this big around, and I've trusted God this much, and it's comfortable, and my life goes and gets bigger. And I roll my little comfort zone around trying to cover the bigger thing. And then I start having to trust God. Second step. Do I believe God can show me a sane way to be in this new area where I didn't used to have an area? And I do the third step, and I start doing inventory on when it's scary, and eventually I catch up spiritually, and then life does it again. And I'm not special. My job is to just keep up. Everybody who does what I do gets what I get. 13 years ago, I knew this guy who was 13 years prior to meeting him, he was living in the dry storage shed behind the five-star restaurant where he was a chef. Because if he left, they needed him as their lead chef. But if he left the property, he tended to not come back for days at a time. So he was smoking crack and shooting heroin on piles of rice in a shed out back. Been to treatment 8 times, he was dying. And then something changed, and he got sober. And I meet him 13 years later, and he owns a 5-star restaurant, and he's married to a woman who will gladly tell you that her relationship with God is more important than her relationship with him. And he tells me that he's not special. If I do what he does, I can have what he got. And I am him now. I'm doing a job I love that I believe, there it is exactly what I'm supposed to be doing. Stop it. I'm married to a woman who will happily tell you her relationship to God with God is more important than her relationship to me. And my spiritual growth is still the number one thing I'm interested in. And you guys can have what I got. I'm not special. Do what I do, you get what I get. Awesome is great. But you can all be awesome. I've just been trying for 18 years. That's the only difference in you and me. Don't believe that crap in meetings. There's no difference in a guy with 10 years and 10 minutes. Because that makes the guy with 10 minutes want to quit, because this is as good as it gets. Don't quit. It gets way better. But anything is possible. If you have the courage to reach for it and to admit you're worth it, and you are. You absolutely are. Thanks for your time.